You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Okay, all right. Good morning, and thank you for being here today. We know it's a very busy week, and there are lots of events, so we're delighted that you chose this one. But we are not surprised that you chose it, because we're having Minister Gordon, who does not need any introduction. You have his bio as a handout, though, and he's Minister of Finance for the second time for South Africa. Thank you very much, Minister Gordon. We know it's a busy week, and we really appreciate that you taking the time to come here. So I will start with a few Q&A with the minister, and then just open it to the floor. And hopefully we can finish on time at 9 o'clock to leave the minister some time to go to his next meeting. Mr. Minister, if you look at the news these days,
I try and avoid it if I can.
So if you look at the IMF revisions of growth forecast for Africa, which just got out for, in the World Economic Outlook, growth forecast for the whole sub-Saharan African region have been revised downward. But for South Africa in particular, growth is expected to be halved to 0.6%. I know in the budget we had this figure of 0.9%. And the IMF is mentioning a couple of factors to explain its revision of growth forecast. Of course, external factors like low export prices, but also policy uncertainty and tighter monetary and fiscal policy. At the same time, if you look at the news like we do, you see that the rand has reached a four-month high and, quote, as confidence returns in the news. And also South Africa just raised in the international debt market a $1.25 billion bond for 19 years at a spread of 335 basis points, so which is about a little bit less than 5% compared to the Ghanas, and which are around 10% or more. So how should we read those two types of signals that we're getting? On the one hand, the growth forecast is being revised downward. On the other hand, we're seeing that there is some positive sentiment coming back.
Well, good morning to all of you, and also on behalf of my South African colleagues, thank you for being here at 8 o'clock in the morning. I see some bleary eyes still as well. I suppose we need to start by saying that South Africa is very different from most, if not all, the African countries, and indeed many developing countries as well. Since the Democratic government came into office in 1994, we've had, on the one hand, a repair of our national balance sheet, which ensured that debt came under control, deficits were managed properly, and by the late 1990s, we were on a very secure fiscal footing for a start, together with the independence that the Reserve Bank or Central Bank enjoyed in terms of our new constitution, which was adopted in 1996. Since then, and up to 2008, as I said yesterday to another audience, so some of you might have been there, we've actually, as I say to South Africans, never broken a fiscal promise. In other words, if we said that we would meet a particular deficit target, unless something extraordinary happens, we would meet that deficit target, which is what we've been doing since 2009 and 2010. Our disruption post 2008 comes from, as I pointed out yesterday, from your shores, because we were going at 4% growth. Our debt to GDP ratio was well below 25%. We had a fiscal surplus in the 2008-2009 years in South Africa. all of which post 2009 and the Great Recession coming to our shores was utilized to ensure we borrow more, we do not impact negatively on the social spending in South Africa, which by and large we've been able to sustain up to now. And whilst we've cut expenditure in many different forms, we have not resorted to what the Europeans would call austerity. Nobody's pensions have been cut. Social assistance has not been cut. Major social programs, education, health, housing, etc., have not suffered negatively at all. In the most recent budget, we've had to take a bit of money and push it back in expenditure terms into outer years, but that does not negatively impact upon our delivery by any means. But what is unique about our country amongst emerging markets is that post the Great Recession, although there was a slight peak in growth in 2010, we haven't recovered as many others did. But many others who did recover today find themselves in negative territory as well. Brazil is an excellent example of a country that's grappling with the same issues as well. So as we said today, we recognize that whilst we are managing the macroeconomic side, both fiscal and monetary, fairly adequately, the big issue confronting South Africa is growth, and in particular, inclusive growth. If you want to talk about social cohesion or economic inclusion or exclusion, South Africa is a classic example given the kind of history that we've had of marginalization of the majority of South Africans. And whilst we've made tremendous progress in the last 20 years, that marginalization is still one that is deeply felt. Secondly, we have, let's call it first-level structural problems and deeper structural problems. So the first-level problems is how do we get better electricity supply, which we will in the next 5 years. Secondly, how do we manage our labor relations environment and reconstruct it in a way in which we have more harmonious relationships, less lengthy strikes within our own country, which begin to negatively impact on growth. And then we come to the more structural, the deep structural reforms that we need to undertake related to our past. So we still have a very oligopolistic economy. There's huge concentration in many important sectors of the economy in the hands of very few companies. So the IMF and OECD will regularly say we need to reform our product market or deconcentrate our product market. Very nice euphemisms. But in essence, what they're saying is get more small businesses and medium-sized businesses to start competing with big businesses and get some space for themselves. So in sum, the growth challenge is one that in some ways the IMF figures begin to reflect. Our response to that is to, certainly in recent months, build confidence amongst the private sector, which has capital that we don't have at this point in time, in the quantities that are actually required. Secondly, encourage them to become partners with us in ensuring to the best of our ability that we don't get downgraded to junk status in the coming weeks. Thirdly, to look at co-investment projects between the private sector and government, whether it is in respect of renewable energy, IPPs in relation to coal and gas, co-generation of energy by mining firms, for example, through small plants being created, or in infrastructure and other ventures which will give us greater competitiveness. We're also exploring new areas of the economy, one utilizing the weak exchange rate. So there's been a significant rise in tourists coming to South Africa. We have some application forms in the front here, if you want to join the queue. The second area, for example, is what we call the oceans economy, where both servicing of ships, repairs to ships on the one hand, but exploring the long shoreline that we have has become quite a priority project within our government as well. And the raising of the bond and the optimism, if one can call it that, that has been shown by bond investors, in a sense reflects some of these dynamics that are at play within the country. And there can't be any doubt in the minds of either ratings agencies or those that we owe somewhere between 1.7 and 2 trillion rands to, that we have both the willingness and the ability to pay when that is necessary. And that's been our record over the years. So for many industrial sectors, we still remain a very attractive destination for FDI. What we require is FDI on a much larger scale and investment by South African companies on a larger scale. So scale is the issue, not the trend that we're actually seeing. And we need to resolve some of these constraints that I've outlined in a more assertive and urgent way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I would like to come back to this issue of social cohesion that you mentioned. But before that, please allow me to go a little bit into the details of the budget, which we read with great attention. So we feel that the budget sets a middle course when it comes to fiscal consolidation, which leaves structural measures as a very important policy tool. But there are some questions about the implementation and the pace of implementation of those structural measures. So it would be great if you could elaborate on, the plan regarding state-owned companies and their reform, and also the structural reforms regarding infrastructure, and especially about the pace. So at one hand, we need growth. The course is set. Structural reforms are an important lever, but will they deliver in time for the country to grow faster?
Well, one, there's no guarantees, as you know, in this regard, nor are there textbook chapters that you could open and say if you do one, two, three, you will get that outcome. But in both those respects, we have, firstly, a realization, take the state-owned companies, that their current forms of governance, management skills, and financial capability and stability is not as a collective way it actually should be. Some do very well, some not so well. So over the last 6 to 8 weeks, we've had a process championed by our deputy president. In fact, I met him on Tuesday before leaving for Washington, and a group of ministers whose task it is in the next few weeks is to propose a different way in which, as a state and as a shareholder, we manage state-owned companies. Selection of boards of directors, the way in which management is chosen to ensure that they have the right kind of skills, a review of the financial stability and capabilities of each of these institutions, and where necessary, certainly amongst the smaller state-owned companies or enterprises, to either merge them or close them down over a period of time where there's duplication. One example that we've announced that work will now begin on is South African Express, which is a small company that belongs to the same stable as South African Airways, broadly speaking, and South African Airways itself, and making it a single company and rationalizing the capabilities that they have, so we pull both of them, hopefully, out of trouble. On infrastructure, we've been doing very well over the last 5 or 6 years, spending approximately 900 billion rands over three-year periods over the past, and some 850 billion rands in the coming three-year period. And the coming three-year period is quite different in composition of spend compared to the past. In the past, a large percentage of the spend was concentrated in Eskom and Transnet. Transnet is a logistics company. Eskom, the energy company. In the coming 3 years, you have a much more diverse portfolio of spending, water and sanitation, housing, roads, including then energy and logistics as well. What we are certainly exploring at this stage is, as you pointed out, a more accelerated way of implementing these projects, but ensuring at the same time that the proper project cycles are actually gone through so that we don't take unnecessary risks in this regard. And we'll be looking at new ways of financing some of these projects, and in particular, looking at possibilities for co-investment by the private sector in some of them.
Great. Thank you very much. Now, in addition to fiscal consolidation and structural reforms, it seems that, at least in the budget speech, there is a third policy tool that is suggested. And I read, you mentioned the need to act together to address declining confidence and the retreat of capital and so on. And you mentioned these partnerships among role players. What do you really mean?
Well, as I indicated, that, you know, we still have quite intense political debates about the role of different role players. So if we're talking about the business sector, there'll be a section of our political family and outside that will say, yes, the business sector is a friend, let's get involved. Others will say, no, we don't trust these guys, let's not get them involved. Similarly, business and labor will have particular views of each other. And the call that we've been making and intensifying is that what we need to achieve as a country can't be done by any one role player on their own. Mm-hmm. Secondly, that we do require to create some kind of platform for a social compact or a social contract that at least can take us through the next 3 to 5 years and beyond, ideally, as well. And thirdly, that we need to intensify our efforts to build an element of operational cooperation and minimal trust amongst these role players and so that we can move and not be paralyzed as we have appeared to be. And there's very intense efforts in each of these regards, both in respect of the business sector. For example, the president and deputy president met a group of 120 business leaders mm-hmm. just before the State of the Nation address on the 9th of February, and a further meeting will take place sometime early in May. I think this Friday there's a meeting between the senior leaders in our government and the labor constituency as well. And at the same time, business and labor have been talking as well. And they're getting fairly close to resolving issues such as balloting before a strike actually takes place, narrowing the gap between them on what should be and how should the minimum wage operate within the South African context? How do we reduce the number of days that are lost through strikes mm-hmm. as well? So I'm optimistic that we're moving in the right direction and that we could deliver some results.
Great. Thank you. And now moving to social cohesion, given the unemployment rate and the inequality in the country, there's this need to create jobs, remove regulatory constraints in some sectors. So the budget mentioned less energy-intensive but also more labor-intensive jobs such as tourism, the ocean economy, which you referred to, agriculture and agro-processing. But again, could you tell us more about the implementation of those policies? What do you have in mind? Really?
Politicians must only talk about what they want to achieve, not what they're going to do. Now, implementation is usually a major challenge for both businesses and governments in many respects. And in each of those areas, that's a challenge that we both are trying to overcome and intend to overcome. We've adopted a methodology that has its origins in Malaysia, the quick, fast, something, something. But we've given it our own South African name called Operation Pakisa, which means that you get all of the stakeholders in one room, so to speak, over a six-week period, and have a very directed set of conversations about how a particular objective is to be achieved or a problem is to be solved. Now, that is what has happened in relation to mm-hmm. the ocean's economy. Mm-hmm. And an intellectual foundation has been created, if you like, mm-hmm. In a city called Port Elizabeth or Nelson Mandela Bay Municipality, mm-hmm. where we have a municipality, a university, and that university is now beginning to become a center of excellence in relation to the ocean's economy. And I think there's a lot more confidence that using this kind of approach, where there's very clear role definition of each of the players, mm-hmm. we will get the implementation processes moving faster. On the infrastructure side, some things work well and others don't. And that clearly is an area that we need to do more work on.
Thank you. So my last question will be on urbanization.
It better be the last, otherwise you're going to fall asleep.
And that urbanization is something that we feel here at Brookings is very important for the continent. So some of our colleagues from the metro, we have a metro department, made a trip to the Gauteng city region and came back very excited. But when we look at other countries in the region, we find it very difficult to emulate a little bit the example of this Gauteng city region. We're looking for leadership on urbanization, basically. So can you tell us a little bit more about the experience, for example, how your ministry deals with this Gauteng city region? In some other countries, we have very difficult relationship between the central government and municipalities and so on. So that would be something we'd appreciate.
Well, urbanization is a phenomenon that none of us can either deny or stop. And in the South African context, I think by 2020, some 60% or more of our population is going to be urbanized in one form or another. Secondly, it's the metropolitan municipalities, but other major cities as well, that act as magnets for opportunity, both for South Africans and for people from within the region as well. So South Africa is a host to many million people, millions of people from neighboring countries, who both contribute to our economy, but become part of the dependence on the social wage in the South African context as well. The Gauteng city region, Gauteng is a province. I'm not sure how many of you have heard of Gauteng in the room. Okay, so let me explain. So Gauteng is one of nine provinces in South Africa, but it produces, 60% of South Africa's GDP. So that's where Johannesburg is, where Pretoria is, where the major international airport is. And it's the financial center of Africa in many ways at this point in time, and perhaps for a long period of time as well. And it has three metropolitan municipalities, one near the airport called Ekurhuleni, one where the executive seat of government is, Pretoria, and the other is Johannesburg, which is well known to all of you probably. And the idea there is that these three metro municipalities, if you put them together, cover 90% of the geographic area of the province of Gauteng. And for planning purposes, for example, you can't have three metro municipalities planning, for example, housing development or even spatial planning within that region, and the province doing its own planning as well. So the city region is an important project to understand all of these entities and create a basis for collective planning, collective action, and collective envisioning of the kind of future that could the sort of region could actually move into. At some stage, we might talk, and there is, let's call it speculation, but nothing in real terms at the moment, where the three metro municipalities could disappear, and Gauteng could be the equivalent of one of your big regions in the U.S. or other parts of the world as well. Managing urbanization is a difficult one, given the kind of, spatial legacy that we come with from our past. So South Africa still has the majority of its black population living approximately where they lived 30 years ago. Nothing major has changed. Some of you have been involved in housing projects and so on, which are intended to spatially integrate our cities and create more economic possibilities, better transport systems. But transport remains a big weakness, public transport in particular, in compensating for the spatial disparities that we have in our country as well. The National Treasury is involved in providing support together with the World Bank to these metropolitan municipalities to see how we could assist them with better planning in some of these regards and developing the skills that the metropolitan municipalities will require to manage the urbanization process as we go forward. We also have a separate ministry, which is where I was before I returned to this job, which is also responsible for municipalities. And the other processes that that department also gets engaged with the metropolitan municipalities. I think a big topic globally and in South Africa now is the role of cities in economic development. The Doing Business report focused on 8 of these metro municipalities by the World Bank, which was published late last year, is a very useful platform for us to start engaging the governance structures in metro municipalities about what they do well and what they don't do well and what they need to do better if they're to provide the right kind of support for economic development and investment in their cities as well. And again, the City Region Project and the province of Gauteng is doing some excellent work in that regard to create fora where these governmental agents constantly interact with businesses, understand what their needs are, and find the ways of actually responding to those needs in both a proactive way, but also through greater responsiveness as well. So in sum, remember, our structures of government are sometimes less than 20 years old. And whilst the metro municipality boundaries are approximately around for 10, 15 years, many of the other municipalities are going through boundary changes each time we have elections because we want to reduce the number of municipalities that we have in South Africa. We also have a group of municipalities in peri-urban, peri-rural and rural areas that don't quite have the fiscal capacity that the more developed municipalities have. And in the coming years, we need to develop alternate ways of supporting them also.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Okay, now is the time that we've all been waiting for. There's coffee in the back, too, for those who have been bored by what I've been talking about. But I'm going to open the floor to Q&A.
Or comments.
Comments, too. Please keep your comments brief and identify yourself. And we have about 20 minutes for that. And, yeah, so I think there's one hand there. One hand here.
Thank you. Yes, good morning. My name is David Marsh from OMFIF. That's a think tank in London. I'd like to ask a question, if I may, on the external front regarding monetary reserves. Two things. We've had this BRICS bank set up with great fanfare about a year ago with this famous contingency reserve agreement. Could you tell us under what circumstances that could be used? Because quite a number of the countries in that group, not so much you, but some of the previous high flyers like Brazil are in a bit of trouble on the external front. Could we foresee that being used? And then you've had a bit of a fillip from the gold price increase, and your monetary reserves are actually not looking too bad compared with, say, Nigeria. Could you tell us a bit about what that means for South Africa as an economy, the fact that the gold price has gone up now after those years in the doldrums?
Maybe we'll take a second question there.
Hi, good morning. I'm Ahmed Fteha from Bloomberg News. I'm sorry, I can't stand up. A local magazine cited S&P saying that downgrade is a real possibility. So how do you see that risk, and what would be the consequence if that happens, if South Africa is indeed downgraded by S&P? Thanks.
Maybe we can take a third one
from
this side this time. We'll come back to this side, but I just need some balance.
Hi, I'm Ken Opala, an assistant professor at Georgetown. I have a question on political risk, sort of similar to the debt situation. So given the murmurings that we've been hearing about a potential downgrade, what do you expect to happen on the political front? Do you see the political situation at the national level in South Africa stabilizing, or should we expect more turbulence on that front, especially in anticipation of the municipal elections that are coming up?
That'd be okay.
We'll take two more.
Okay, we'll take two more. So I have the gentleman there with raising his hand.
Thank you.
I Barry really Wood. Need this side of the floor to be a little bit more dynamic.
Hello. Barry Wood, MoneyWeb. I'd like to ask you, Minister, in terms of, first of all, congratulations on the rebound in the RAND and rebuilding confidence. How much further do you
have a lot of influence.
How much further do you have to go in your talks this week? I know you'd like to avoid the downgrade, but would you say you're halfway there of rebuilding confidence in South Africa, or is it a harder task than that?
Okay, I really need one question from this side. Okay, back there.
Thank you. I'd like to hear some good news. So if you could talk about maybe some celebratory activities, or maybe there's a great sporting event that's coming up, something that you could promote that would provoke an interest in visiting South Africa, that would be like the ultimate sales pitch. You need to come and see this right now.
Okay, I think we have the Minister of Finance, so am I right? But, right. Okay.
Well, the good news is that we have a new rugby coach. So hopefully we do better at rugby, but we do reasonably well there. The second is this week, there's the swimming championships in Durban. That's the city I come from, to see who would qualify for the Olympics. And that's many of the leading swimmers were there and qualified. Thirdly, even with the RAND at about 14.50, coming to South Africa to spend your dollars is still a worthwhile proposition. So join the other 16% increase in tourists that are coming to our country. And come and see all the wonders of South Africa, which has a great deal of diversity in what you can enjoy, from mountains to the seaside. And ultimately, South Africans are hopeful, optimistic, and resilient. That we know we've been through lots of difficulties in the past. If we are not hopeful and optimistic on the one hand and resilient on the other, we wouldn't have coped with everything we had to cope with under the apartheid regime. And notwithstanding what is going on, I think we have the wherewithal in our DNA, if you like, to overcome some of the difficulties that we confront now and go beyond. I mean, whenever you're in the middle of a storm, it looks like the worst thing possible. But storms don't last forever. And I think the question is, what level of resilience optimism can you share with your population? But importantly, what kind of wisdom pervades ordinary people in the street in South Africa in order to understand where we are as a country and the kind of expectations people still have of a better life, which I think we can achieve in due course if we solve some of our problems. Which brings me to the downgrade issue. I mean, we can't tell ratings agencies what to do. But we can say to them that, remember, the recession had nothing to do with South Africa. And, you know, sometimes we have very short memories. It actually was imported, if you like, or exported to South Africa. Secondly, that we do have a very significantly stable approach to fiscal management and monetary management in South Africa. Thirdly, our fault lines in terms of what our legacy has given us, some of which I described earlier on, are also well known. Fourth, where are we in terms of building confidence? I'm amazed at the amount of positive cooperation we're getting at the moment, because South Africans, whether you're the ordinary person in the street who's going to suffer from increased inflation and at the moment because of the drought we're experiencing that, in potential increases in food prices, or whether you are a bank that has to worry about additional borrowing costs as a result of the downgrade, all of us are united in our intent to make sure that we put our best foot forward and don't move in that particular direction. And I think we have a case. I think we have a case. And in the next couple of weeks, we'll be able to demonstrate why we have a case for none of the ratings agencies to do anything drastic which would harm South Africa in the medium term. But if in their view, or in the view of some of the ratings agencies, a downgrade is necessary to junk status, I'm not sure whether all of them will move in the same direction at the same time. And it means that another battle has to be fought in order to recover investment grade status for South Africa, if that actually has to happen. So we will continue with our work, and we have a lot of work that we've done both within government and in the private, with the private sector and labor, which we'll be able to talk about shortly and indicate that we're not sitting on our haunches, and that we are actively trying to overcome some of the challenges that we have, and that we have plans that we are intent upon implementing, not just talking about them, which is a requirement that many have actually put to us. So we're on our way, and, you know, as South Africans, we try our best until the last moment. So we're going to give it our best shot and hopefully achieve the kind of objective that many would like us to actually achieve. The consequences of a downgrade, technically speaking, are well known. You know, you'll get some capital leaving, you'll get inflation increasing, and that then could set into motion a number of other factors as well. Whether that actually happens or not will depend on the kind of optimism that we can maintain both within the South African body politic and more generally in society, and the way we are perceived. Now, remember, we're living in a world today. The IMF didn't only downgrade South Africa's numbers, it downgraded virtually the whole world's numbers in the last couple of days. And the fascinating thing in 24 hours of conversations in Washington is that nobody can quite tell us categorically what is this ailment that the global economy is suffering from. What exactly do we pinpoint as the three causes of this gloominess on the one hand, the continuous downgrade of growth prospects on the other hand, and the inability of the institutions that exist to use some kind of diagnostic to spur the world into action as we did in 2008, 2009, when we did save the banking system of the world, particularly in the developed countries. The United States one in particular, but others as well. There's still remnants of the impact on the banking system that we can feel in Europe, for example, that hasn't quite been resolved yet. So we're living in a global context where demand is low, productivity is low, growth is low, investment is low. The experiment with negative interest rates is raising more concerns and debates rather than the categorical answer that we thought it would actually produce. Trade is low as well. So all of these factors are moving in the wrong direction, and surely they will then impact upon Africa more generally and the most developed economy within the continent as well. But our approach is not to keep pointing outside our borders and say that's where the problem is. We've got our own challenges and difficulties and potential and opportunities. And it's important to focus on those and rally South Africans behind that set of initiatives so that we could go where we wherever we can in terms of improving the situation. The new development bank, it's very much alive and well. I have a colleague here who can give you a blow-by-blow account of the fact that, A, it is established, B, it's got its key personnel in place, C, it's actually advertised for more personnel, and that process will be concluded in the next few months. The first batches of capital have actually been paid in. The request for projects has gone out. The five countries have responded to the request for projects. A screening process has been completed, and decisions will be announced shortly by the BRICS leaders in terms of which of the projects are to be supported. So the BRICS Bank is working, and working faster than perhaps any other institution of a similar sort in our history. South African reserves have been always around $50 billion. Plus, minus, and depending on exchange rate and other considerations, they swing between 46 and 50 in terms of the numbers that we've seen. The increase in gold price hopefully helps the industry. Gold mining now is 3 or 4 kilometers down below the surface of the earth. Costs are high, and any increase in gold price makes marginal mines more productive, and it helps the industry to keep people at work over a period of time. So I think I've answered all of the questions.
Yes, sure.
Thank you.
So just before I open, we're having an event on the global economy with Jason Furman from the Council of Economic Advisors, and I think on Friday. On Friday. So we will also continue this conversation. So if you're interested, please join us. One question here. Then another there.
Thank you, Amadou. My name is Tom Getman, and I'm a consultant and board member in South Africa. Mr. Minister, you spoke quite eloquently yesterday about the land distribution issue, but could we hear a little bit more about the best practice process that's being sought, especially in the Eastern Cape, which has vast land areas that can be very productive? And then a question that's in a lot of people's minds here is, since you make good sense, any chance you could stand for president in the next round?
So we have, I have that gentleman there, but let's go to the left here, the lady in the front, and then we'll come back to that gentleman there.
Hi, I'm Chloe McGraw. I'm a graduate student here. I think no discussion about the South African economy is really complete without some attention being paid to the recent Constitutional Court case. And I'm wondering really if you could speak to that. I think we're all aware of the important advances that were made towards protecting democracy in the Constitution of 96, and one of those being the public protector. And I think the president's recent disregard for her recommendations have caused a lot of concern about the future of South African leadership. So perhaps you could just speak to how the outcome or the president responding to the to the result of the Concord case will influence the markets, if at all.
Take a third question there on the next to the wall.
Good morning, Minister Gordon. Amadou C. David McGill of Insight Consulting. Minister Gordon, when you mentioned, when you were speaking of infrastructure, you mentioned that mention of looking at new ways of financing and co-investment with the private sector. A lot of people talk about PPPs, you know, not in terms of simply financial obligations, but allocation of risks and the government and private sector being positioned to exploit a particular competency. When you mentioned co-investment, is it the same as a PPP, or was there a different sort of arrangement that was unique that you were envisioning for infrastructure financing in South Africa?
We have 10 minutes left, so if...
These are the last questions.
These are the last set of questions.
Going.
Yeah.
Okay. There's one there.
So there's one.
Hi, my name's Rachel, and I work with Talent Beyond Boundaries. And AdCorp did a recent study that realized that there's 800,000 unfilled skilled positions in South Africa. And I imagine that stunts the economic growth, so I was wondering if there are programs or how that's being addressed. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We have, I think, 5 questions.
Okay. On the land issue, I grew up in the middle of a city. So all I knew was tar, bricks, and mortar. So me and agriculture don't quite get along too well. But if I had our director general here, he'll wax lyrical because he comes from the Eastern Cape. But broadly speaking, the potential is still huge on the agriculture side. There are, I think, very good examples of established farmers assisting new entrants to farming and creating very viable enterprises, whether it's the wine farming or grape farming in the Western Cape or similar. I know the sugarcane farming in KwaZulu-Natal and Mpumalanga have fascinating experiments where a leg up, so to speak, has been provided to new and small farmers in order that they could fit into the production process, fit into the supply chain, get access to markets, and begin to operate on a much more sophisticated basis as a commercial enterprise. So those best practices are there. Again, as I said yesterday, I might have said it earlier, the issue for us is scale. If you could magnify some of these best practices by 10,000, literally overnight, and I think we have the potential to do it, it will make a huge difference to people in the kind of way in which they see life prospects and develop both commercial and farming skills as well. And if you get the value chain right, and access to markets in particular, it could become a very viable way of earning a living and bringing up a family in our own environment. Co-investment and PPPs, let me put it differently. What we're saying is there's a whole range of possibilities for financing infrastructure projects. So we have very excellent PPPs in the roads network that SANRAL has put together over the last, 15 years or so. And those mainly are different forms of PPPs. But PPPs take time to put together. They require skills on both ends, both the private sector and the public sector, in terms of ensuring, as you said, that the spread of risk is done in the right kind of way. And often when inexperienced people get involved, you get risk loaded onto the government side and the private sector walks away with all of the benefits. But the whole idea here is to leverage all of the resources that are available. So we have an organization called ACESA that brings together asset managers, insurance companies, and the financial sector more generally. And they are looking at new ways of investing within South African infrastructure projects as well. If you have time, there's a lady sitting in front here who's got a lot of experience in housing projects in South Africa. So our colleague here can decide whether you want a two-minute advert from her about how well things can work in this kind of way. Because those are real-life examples of what we are actually talking about. Skills and unfilled jobs, there is a mismatch. There's no doubt in the South African context that we are looking at. What we are doing through the higher education department at the moment is increasing and strengthening existing skills development and vocational training institutions. They exist, but their quality needs to be improved, and their output needs to be improved as well, the quality of people emerging. Mm-hmm. The link between those processes and the private sector, which some countries do very well, broke down somewhere along the line in the last 10, 15 years, and we need to now rebuild and are in the process of rebuilding so that we get artisans and young people who have opportunities to actually train while they are being educated. The third is we need to educate our young people a little better that not everybody is either going to get a university degree or needs a university degree. And Northern Europe in many ways provides excellent examples, as do some parts of the United States as well. I was in an event last night where we were talking about this. So that's the one set of problems. The second is information asymmetry. The information is sitting in urban areas, and those living in peri-urban or quasi-rural areas just don't have access. Mm-hmm. The third is transport costs. So a young person might have some idea of where to go, but the ability to pay 50 rands or 100 rands to get to that place and explore the possibilities becomes extremely difficult from what we've learned. But all of those areas are being attended to by colleagues in government. On the Constitutional Court case, what the Constitutional Court did some days ago is to bring life to our Constitution. So Mr. Mashlangu here, who's the ambassador of South Africa to the United States, and myself played a small part, if he doesn't mind me saying so, in the constitutional development process in the early 90s. And establishing a constitutional state, the institution of the Constitutional Court, and having the Constitution as the supreme law in South Africa were very important developmental steps in creating the foundations for a democracy. And the court has certainly come to the party and clarified exactly what can the public protector do, how much of weight is attached to these remedial actions of the public protector. And if you disagree with some element of their judgment, what are the processes to be followed, i.e. go to court and ask the court to give you clarity. The second element in respect of the specifics is the National Treasury has been asked to establish what amount of money is to be paid, and I think the words are a reasonable amount based on the reasonable cost. The word reasonable is put in because costs were escalated for each of those items that were actually produced. So there's another way, a process by which the state will recover those additional costs and hold those people accountable. Our job in the next 5 weeks is to go back to court with experts doing some work in this area and put an amount on the table that has been agreed that will be paid. In terms of influencing the markets, well, we've always said we have a solid democracy. And the markets in some ways have observed that, although there's a multiplicity of factors that might have influenced the kind of direction that the markets have taken. But I think, importantly, the Constitutional Court and us as a country have reaffirmed our faith in our Constitution. And constitutions are just, at one level, pieces of paper, ask the people of the United States. It's these sorts of events that give it life, give it meaning, educate people about what its significance is, and educate people about what the Constitution means for them at a day-to-day level. And so over the next 10, 15, 20 years, we will consolidate, as people in other parts of the world do, a keener knowledge amongst the South African public as to what does this Constitution mean and how do they ensure that it benefits everybody in our country. So finally, thank you very much for having me and my colleagues.
And we're finishing exactly on time. So
great.
I have 8:59 actually, but thank you very much. I hope you have enjoyed this discussion as much as we have, and that we can all take better informed decisions based on what we've learned today and what we can continue to learn through the coming weeks. Thank you again. Okay.